So I guess you guys all went through Dr. Chadha's lecture on the clinical side of prostate cancer, right? And so I do have a paper for you. It's very important because my question is directly related to this paper. I can tell you this. If you have any questions about the paper that you don't understand, either shoot me a short email or come to my office. The paper obviously is from our own institution, Dr. David Guru's laboratory, published earlier this year. It drives a very important point that I am going to cover today in my lecture. So, if you really think about Dr. Chadha's lecture, right, I mean, with so many prostate cancer patients each year, quarter million patients almost, 24, 25 patients who die from prostate cancer, and one of the major therapeutic modalities in the clinic, that is castration, or called ADT, androgen deprivation therapy, has been in clinical use for more than 7 years. And so if then you ask the real question then on the average, how much longer do prostate cancer patients leave this is compared to 70 years ago. Just as the prostate cancer, the cervical mortality, it's probably overall maybe 45 years. 70 years later, disease is almost in the level. So I'm not saying that we should not treat the patients, especially with this locally advanced and myostatic patients, we should treat them. I guess as a cancer biologist, the duty here is really from the biological perspective. How can we understand the cancer evolution? How can we understand the tumor cell response to different therapies, especially targeted therapies? Okay, and I think that's what I wanted to achieve at the end of my talk today, that you can kind of make a little bit of sense of treatment failure from tumor cell biology. And specifically what I wanted to cover, let me see what I have those keywords right here somewhere. Yeah, I guess I do. I have some the catchphrase these days, the cancer cell heterogeneity, yeah, and then stem cells, cancer stem cells, cell lineage, cancer cell plasticity. And so during my talk that you will perhaps gradually appreciate why this biological determinants dramatically affect how the tumor as one ecosystem really responds, a specific tumor responds to one type of treatment. And in fact that I'm going to utilize androgen receptor targeting therapy as sort of the prime example in my talk, but the basic principles I'm going to elaborate today, I can guarantee you, can be applied to understanding cancer cell response to virtually all different types of treatments. So it is about the cancer cell heterogeneity. And I kind of summarized this based on some of my past lecture materials and also Dr. Chadha's. And obviously, as I mentioned, that Dr. Chuck Higgins, who got a Nobel Prize because of his fundamental discoveries that androgen signaling, the hormones represent the driving force of prostate tumor development. So I guess that it's probably true. You can categorically say that the human prostate cancer is an androgen-driven tumor. Without the androgen receptor signaling, you will not, or patient Joe will not get a clinically detectable tumor. That statement, I would say, is probably categorically right. Okay, so that explains why that virtually all these ADT modalities have achieved a dramatic clinical efficacy. In fact, if you look at, I trained as a pathologist, so I know a little bit about the clinical side of that. If you look at the sort of like the tumor response in the clinic, all those different types of tumors, the response, the clinical response of human prostate tumors to castration, I would have to say is among the best. In terms of if you utilize the shrinkage of the primary tumor burden as the measurement of treatment success. In that regard, prostate cancer response to androgen deprivation therapy is among the best. Because you can feel, I mean, a lot of patients actually, you know, I mentioned our child that first, you know, went to medical oncology with urologists because they have difficulty peeing, cannot pee, because the tumors have grown so much and impinging on the urethra, so they cannot, you know, I don't know what you guys actually, that's why the morbid pH, there's a movie called Crush. Right, the guy, his father. Anybody watching the movie Crush? All right, never mind. Okay, so castration came on many years ago, and that led to the chemicals that block the basically the testicular androgen production. So in the body, 90% of the testosterone is derived from the testicles. So this luteinizing hormone, releasing hormone, agonist or antagonist, they work differently. Remember that the child mentioned this in terms of time frame. They basically shut down the testicular production of the embryo. So eventually leading to the feminization of men. And we start, so later the drugs called the Lupron, Luprolide, and so those are the first line castration regimens. So 7 years later, the moment when a medical oncologist decides to put a patient onto anti-androgen therapy, that patient will be put on Lupron first. Okay, so that the patient will be on that Lupron all the time. So basically, that there is very little androgen production systemically. But as they also mentioned that, you know, we do have about 10% of androgens derived from adrenal gland, and that is not shut down by LHRH agonist or antagonist. So that's where abiraterone comes right here. Where's the abiraterone? Right here. Okay, so and so that was approved in 2012, and then you have a couple of chemotherapeutic drugs and all this. And so just look at all this, right? I mean, this, and you probably will be wondering, what are these drugs really targeting? So this is something that I will discuss as we move along. So remember that we are not really treating the patient, we're not treating the tumors, we're really treating the cancer cells. So, I mean, medical oncology would say, yeah, we're treating the patient, and then, you know, radiation oncologists, they were treating the tumor. But then if you zoom in, you're really treating specific kinds of cells. So the ultimate question is, with all these different kinds of therapies, and largely, okay, you have basically three major categories. And one are the chemotherapeutic drugs, and together with radiation, they basically target generally my target cells, the cells that are in cell division. And then you have targeted therapies that would basically on the cancer cells that rely on androgen signaling and also androgen receptor for survival. Okay, so that's what we call the targeted therapy. Remember this radium-233, carbazine, docetaxel, those are non-selective. They basically form part of the whole tumor and kill all of the cells that are about to enter mitosis, so there's no selectivity. Okay, and then another type is the immunotherapy, and he mentioned this provincial cephalosil T, and so that was actually the very first anti-cancer vaccine ever developed in the, on this planet, and so the company that made Provenge went overnight virtually from $2 per share to $40 per share. One of my best buddies became a multi-millionaire overnight. He retired 41 years old. And but then what happened? 2 years later, virtually, okay, 2 years later, that the approval by FDA of enzalutamide basically completely abolished the use of prevention, because prevention is a DC-based vaccine. The generation of this therapy It's very cumbersome. It takes about at least 1 month to generate. It's very expensive, much more expensive than this pill. And so the company went bankrupt. And again, overnight, the stock price went from 40-something to $1. Okay, so you can imagine many people probably hung themselves, jumped from the 40th floor, whatever, right? So that's just how it is. And then radium, this is a radionuclear light that has affinity for the bone, basically for calcium phosphate. So you can understand why that medication is good for metastasis. So then there are a lot of other medications over this. So by logic, all this already existing clinical therapies, drugs in development, they all fall into these three categories. Okay, they are androgen targeting therapeutics, and then chemotherapeutic drugs that basically block the cell proliferation, and then finally immunotherapies that, to me, are very, very mysterious. The reason is that I don't know how many of you attended Austin's retreat, institutional retreat, that I mentioned this. By my assessment, all this immunotherapeutic, the majority of this immunotherapeutic has been targeting exactly the same population of cells as the AR expressing cells. So to a certain degree, you're asking yourself the philosophical question, all of this, okay, I think I have one, I'm not really in the detail of some of this. Let me see what I have. The important slide that probably is not here. But Dr. Chalker made that point that basically all these different regimens spend patients' life by anywhere from 2.3 months to 4.6 years. 7 years, it's about the same. So without doing any experiments, you scratch your head, you ask yourself, why? And as I just told you, that we are treating specific kinds of cell populations, okay? So there's a possibility. If not all, the majority of these treatment modalities are pretty much targeting the same population of the cells, leaving a very important population untouched or behind. And that population will become absolutely critical when the sensitive population gets eliminated. That is the concept of cancer cell heterogeneity. And to make it worse, that all the current mortality modalities may not even be able to wipe out all the sensitive population and will push some of 10%, 20% of the sensitive cells kind of backwards to the insensitive cells. That's why virtually with every cancer cell model, if you expose them to low doses of any of the therapeutics, you can select for drug-resistant cell lines. Now you go back to the drug-resistant lines, they will not be sensitive to any other treatments, mainly because they have been reprogrammed to assume many of the identities, especially epigenetic identities that originally are owned by this insensitive, intrinsically insensitive cell population. That phenomenon is called cellular plasticity. So understanding cell heterogeneity and plasticity, in my opinion, will eventually cure cancer. So some of you might have attended Dr. Max Wisher's lecture. One of the main points he has been driving over the past 20 years is that clinical practice has been wrong all the time because we're using the shrinkage of the primary tumor as the yardstick of success, which is wrong, wrong, wrong. You know? And because you basically end up with a tumor that you can no longer manage. You think that you have debulked 80% tumors, it's good news, but you end up with that little monster there that will come back, which is much more aggressive and much more metastatic than the initial cell. So using anti-AR treatment as a sort of example, okay, I wanted to drive the point that in the clinic, in fact, that people have been, including medical oncology special patients, right? Nowadays, many patients are very knowledgeable. And they have been using this generic term CRTC, castration resistant prostate cancer. But in reality, you have multiple types of prostate cancer. And you can, based on the sort of sequence of treatment, you can primarily, or you can basically think that all these CRTCs can be sort of primary CRPC, secondary CRPC, tertiary CRPC, because those cells have been castrated again and again and again by either one regimen or two regimens or three in combination. And so each round of castration represents a different, what I call reprogramming activity. You are reprogramming, you are castrating, you are basically trying to wipe out the same cell population again and again. So, how do tumor cells develop, when the tumors become primary versus secondary tissue, and I'll come to that. So obviously that our thinking has been limited over the past many decades that everything goes through AR. But you know that's not true, especially in the resistant tumors. They are a different part of the story. Okay, and I'll show you some slides to drive that point. So AR obviously is an important transcription factor that defines who we are, right? And in fact, it's also important for your nerves. You know, AR is utterly important for your brain function. Okay. So I think that if you work on prostate cancer, obviously you want to understand a little bit about the gene, so it's an X chromosome localized gene, and so most of the current clinical standards target the C-terminus ligand binding domain. Okay, so some people are trying to develop the novel therapeutics that target the N-terminal, and so theoretically this will be good because as we now know that the cancer cells become very smart, as you castrate the prostate cancer cells, obviously they can delete the ligand binding domain, you know, generating AR splice variants that no longer get regulated by androgens, by, you know. So it's understandable. And talking about AR, most of the people don't appreciate this point. They only think, oh, AR is very important. Yeah. But what I can tell you, AR is important during tumor progression for sure. But all the AR genomic alterations are caused by men, by our treatment, because in untreated tumors, AR, if anything, you see that one tumor sample has actually deletion in AR. AR is never overexpressed or amplified at the genomic level in untreated tumors. But if you treat the tumors, AR will become invariably amplified up to 60-70% of the tumors. In ADT treated tumors. That's understandable, right? Big guy wanted to punch you, you wanted to, you know, fight back. So now all the ADT targeted androgen receptor, you know, androgen receptor expressing cells will, under the selective pressure, will amplify the target. That is a very basic cancer cell biology concept, that all the targeted therapies you have to be prepared. The target itself will be overexpressed. And then very related signaling molecules will be upregulated. In this case, GR, you know, some retinoid acid signaling pathway that can also engage the AR signaling pathway. Those are all not very surprising. Should not be surprising to you at all. Okay? But that's not what I'm trying to tell you. So again, that, you know, as the tumors progress, that they sustain a lot of mutations and all this. But AR, again, the genomic alterations and amplification of AR is largely caused by castration, by the treatment. And that's a very important point, okay? And another point that I'm trying to drive in this slide is that, as you can imagine, you know, as tumors evolve in vivo, even without treatment, and more so as tumors are being treated by either targeted therapy or those taxol or the chemo, they also undergo genomic and genetic alterations, such as p53, RB mutation. The more advanced the tumors are, the more aggressive tumors are, the more genomic alterations they will sustain. And so that's what Dr. David Gutschler did in that animal model in the Science paper. They modeled the loss of RB1 in the context of P10 mutation or under p53. So if you look at the RB, let me see whether I can find RB somewhere. It's very commonly mutated right here, I think, RB1 right here. See, this is all advanced tumor. Okay, most of the patients probably will not treat it, but they, because you have a high MYC and P10 mutation right here. So if you simultaneously delete two or three genes, you can create a tumor that is very much like this advanced tumor in patients, phenotypically. Okay? So, and one slide to highlight all this AR splice variants of the ROCK, the ligand binding domain. Yeah. So, again, that all this slide basically highlight that the relationship between AR alterations versus other genomic and genetic alterations. Okay. So, then coming back to the main point, so now I'm on this point right now. Stem cells and the protein. That at this point in prostate cancer, right, you really have only sort of like a two defined type of therapy. Chemotherapy that targets proliferating cells, anti-AR, anti-androgen that target androgen receptor expression cells. All the other tyrosine kinase inhibitor, all the radium, whatever, they only apply to a small population of patients, and a lot of them are experimental. So, as I mentioned, we are not for treating a tumor, okay? Sorry, we are treating tumor cells. So, in order to understand whether a tumor will respond to a specific type of treatment, you really want to understand tumor cells. That's very important. So, if you guys are interested in gaining some basic stem cell biology knowledge, go to this paper that I wrote several years ago. And the whole idea is that in virtually every somatic tissue and organ, you have these reserve cells that have the ability to give rise to the protein, therefore the stem cells. Okay? They normally are very quiescent, small population, and but they have enormous proliferative potential. That's the key word, proliferative potential, but normally they're not dividing at all. Their potential needs to be unleashed by, let's say, tissue damage or this kind of thing. And then they give rise to this spectrum of the cells right here. So that's why in every normal, so-called normal, most of the tissue and organs in you guys' bodies are normal. In mine, no. Many of them probably not normal anymore, right? So, but you can see a kaleidoscope of different cell types with different shapes, different morphology, different, you stain them, express different levels of markers and all this. It can all be explained in the using the concept of stem cell development, because this has been done, that you can infuse a single long-term hematopoietic stem cell into a lethally irradiated mouse, and if that mouse does not receive a long-term hematopoietic stem cell upon 7 gray of irradiation, the mouse will die in 2 days. If that mouse receives a single, or not a single, five or so, this long-term hematopoietic stem cells, just that few, and it can reconstitute all the blood lineages, the mice can survive forever. It tells you there are cells like that. So, the whole point is that just like the normal, in a normal tissue and organ, you have spectrum cells at different stages of development, and they also possess different functions. And so, you know, that obviously that in cancer, research in the past 15 years suggests that very similar cellular heterogeneity exists in virtually every tumor. Okay, the only complexity is that we know the actual tumor is more than clonal. Let's say Joe's prostate cancer is not one cancer, it has 12 different clones. And so each clone can have something like this. That complicates the analysis, the interpretation, the understanding. A lot of people think Joe's tumor is one tumor. No. Joe has 12 tumors. Each tumor has a different genetic background. Each clone, so this like 12 different clones, has a different hierarchical organization. So those are the important things to understand. And the cancer cells have plasticity, which means that unlike the normal, like right here, in general, okay, these cells, upon differentiation, they are permanently locked in the epigenetic. They have this epigenetic potential, epigenome plasticity, but normally it does not happen unless you like reprogram, you induce, or it undergoes pathological changes, like, you know, so Dami is going to probably tell you a little bit about epigenetics. And so we talk about reprogramming, and that basically to push the cells, you know, backwards all the way to the top, which means the normal cells, even though differentiated, the epigenome can still be plastic. Okay? So how do we understand the cancer cell heterogeneity using normal stem cell biology? Okay. This is obviously a challenge, and that in these two papers, you can basically sort of like find the discussions on the relationship between cancer stem cells versus tumor progression related to time. As time goes by, you get clonal diversification, then each clone has its cancer stem cells, and then eventually one tumor is dominated by one, most of the malignant, most of the primitive stem cell population or cancer stem cells. Okay, so finally, I wanted to utilize prostate cancer as the model to put all this together to understand prostate cancer cell heterogeneity and plasticity induced by genetic mutations, epigenetic alterations, and the treatment. Okay, so these are the actual human prostate cancer samples. Okay, shown here are the four samples. Three are pathologically diagnosed with Gleason 7. So this is the population that is most frequently operated on. If you remember that Dr. Chapa told you, most of the Gleason 6 patients, they will medical oncologists will tell them, well, let's wait. Okay, let's monitor the PSA. Don't, you know, subject yourself to robotic surgery or whatever. But virtually all Gleason 7 tumor patients are operating on, have their organs taken out. Our laboratory have worked on 237 primary patient tumors from the surgery room. Okay, so we have working on many of these tumor samples, so we know the prostate tumors very well. And what I want to highlight here is this three Gleason 7 tumors, the same pathological diagnosis on the pathologist sheet, you know, trying to meet the patients eventually, right? But if you put them under the microscope, you can see, wow, they look nothing alike. These three Gleason 7 tumors are very different. And obviously, the Gleason 9 tumor is worse because you hardly find any glandular structure. And then if you zoom in into each of these tumors, you can find benign areas, which is relatively benign, but atrophic areas, and you can still find the secretions. And you can find relatively morphologically, structurally differentiated glandular areas right here. And you can find areas that are undifferentiated, very much like a Gleason 8, Gleason 9 tumor. So morphologically, they are very heterogeneous. What is the significance here? Then, I want you to think about molecular heterogeneity. This is the cellular heterogeneity and structural heterogeneity. But when you come to the molecular heterogeneity, one mistake that the whole field has been making over the past 50 years is people, medical oncologists, scientists, oftentimes would simply categorically classify, oh, you know, this is an AR positive tumor. This is a PSA positive tumor. There's no such a thing. Okay? All of the tumors are AR positive. But the truth is, in every so-called AR positive tumor, you can easily identify that they are negative cells. So we have classified this, and we published the papers 2 years ago. And in fact, as much as 40 to 60% of untreated human prostate cancer cells lack their AR expression to start with. Then we look back to the literature. I mean, it's shocking. 20, 30 years ago, when AR was cloned first, antibodies were made, people already did this kind of IDC analysis, already reported this heterogeneity. So, but nobody asked this very simple, I'm a simple-minded person, simple question. If the prostate cancer cells start with so many of the cells that do not express androgen receptor, how do you expect all that tumor to respond to anti-ADT, to anti-androgen-based therapeutics? That's a fundamental question that we've been trying to address for probably 12 to 13 years, and we're making very good progress. So I'm going to tell you something that, for example, right here, we spend an enormous amount of time to define the differential plasma cancer cells marked by high levels of PSA expression versus those cells that do not express PSA. And many years of work allow us to derive this basic framework of understanding, this model. And it basically goes that the majority of the cells in untreated tumors express high levels of PSA. Most of the cells are AR positive. Therefore, these cells are very, very sensitive to anti-androgens. And also importantly, these cells are highly proliferative. They are very sensitive to docetaxel, you know, and the top side. In contrast, these cells are phenotypically less differentiated along differentiated plasma cancer cells from the same tumor. They, a lot of them are dormant. More than 50% of cells lack AR, and therefore, these cells are intrinsically refractory to the two main regimens, clinical regimens, anti-AR and chemotherapeutic drug. And importantly, that this is many of the cells in this pool, we call the PSA negative low pool, have hardcore stem cell activity because at the single cell level, if you trace them on their time-lapse video microscopy, they can undergo asymmetric cell division, generating differentiated cells. I feel bad I did not bring that movie that I have shown to, you know, gazillions of people worldwide. So it shows you beautifully how a single cell right here generating multiple daughters right here. But guess what? All those daughters derived from this one cell are very sensitive to anti-AR, to docetaxel. But that one cell doesn't budge at all. It stays there, it survives, it will come back, generating a large flux of the cells that are kind of mixed up, or even messed up. So, AR, coming back to the AR right here. Okay, what about AR heterogeneity? So that's more relevant because, as I mentioned, right, that the majority of locally advanced, as well as metastatic prostate cancer patients, as well as the primary CRPC patients, will be further treated by anti-AR and the enzalutamide target specific, you know, therapeutics. I'm asking myself the question, are these AR negative cells responsive to those treatments at all? How do we address that question? So this actually is another striking example. This is actually a failed CRPC patient sample, okay? The tag number is 13553. You can see that what kind of heterogeneity in that treatment failed tumor. Yeah, you can appreciate areas in which most of the cancer cells are high on AR, nuclear cytoplasm, compared to the untreated tumor. So that makes sense because as you are cross-treating the cancer cells, some cancer cells will overexpress the target, AR, yes.
So why is then the vaccine not working? Because the vaccine is not targeting it.
So the prevention is specifically targeting this high population of the cells. So the prevention was made using the PAP. So PAP is under the regulation of androgen receptor. It's the expression profile overlapping with PSA. And PSA overlaps the AR positive cells. So therefore, basically the prevention and also all the currently ongoing immunotherapy treatments, they all target this population. I am very bold to make that prediction. I think that all those immunotherapeutic protocols will come up at the best 2 to 3 months, 3 to 4 months, no difference. No difference than enzalutamide. There's no rationale there. The real rationale, I'm telling you, you have to worry about this AR negative population, period. Because you see here, in a treated patient, almost 50% of the areas are completely lacking androgen receptor. So, even if I always say, even if you can, you know, stop all the intracrine or intratumor androgen production, you find that most of the potent anti-AR drug, it gets into the tumor, all this, those 50% of AR negative cells, we're not a botch, right? Because we have developed a system that have tested that. And final couple of slides I can tell you. For example, Over the years, one senior postdoc in the lab has been really working hard trying to find the Zinghoff model system that can recapitulate these two populations, AR negative, AR positive, and then ask defining the questions, how do they respond to the current, most of the advanced anti-energy, vedolizumab? He succeeded in abandoning the two, right here. The Linkup model, you see largely AR positive, high. LPC9, on the other hand, largely AR negative, low. So now, if you take these two Zinghoff primary CRPCs, you treat them with vedolizumab, what happens? You look at the Linkup model, it has an AR, you see here's the vedolizumab, the clinical drug. The vehicle treated tumors grow very fast. By about 4 to 5 weeks, all the animals had to be sacrificed. In contrast, when most of the animals were sacrificed in the control group, there was hardly any tumor development at all in the AR positive Linkup CRPC, primary CRPC. So if you stop the experiments right here, gentlemen and the ladies, you will see, wow, you see how beautiful enzalutamide is working against this AR high cells. There's beautiful suppression. There's no tumor development. This is just like in the clinic. We were happy, medical oncologists are happy, telling patients, yes, John, it's responding. Not you, John, a different John. Okay, so but then after 7 months, 7 weeks, you begin to see enzalutamide resistant tumors begin to show up. But this is not the case with the AR negative model right here. There's no AR. Guess what? The tumors do not respond to enzalutamide at all. Okay? When you don't have an AR, they won't respond. So if you take that back to this clinical sample, it basically tells you, you can still further castrate these tumor cells, probably get some response, but these tumor cells will not respond anyway. So very recently, let me see what I have done there. Oops. I guess I don't have that. But we also accomplished something. So a graduate student who is defending in about 2 weeks, she utilized CRISPR-Cas9 to generate isogenic AR positive, AR knockout, and also AR target homogeneous AR positive cells. She created isogenic systems. So in 5 years, she has provided extremely convincing evidence that AR is only relevant to anti AR therapy. If you don't have AR negative tumors, they don't matter. You put them, they are so aggressive. You put them in fully cultured mice, they develop tumors like hell. So, and I don't have the data to show you. We're preparing a manuscript. So together, it will be for the first time to show to the whole world that basically the attention really needs to be turned into this cell. And to make it worse, that we have strong evidence to show that you can actually turn this AR positive cells into AR negative cells. And so finally, this is a different concept, it's reprogrammed as a kind of cell plasticity. And we showed that if you simply overexpress one, then this factor called the nano, which is normally important for the pluripotency and self renewal of the embryonic stem cells, you can gradually, just like the iPS, but here the difference is the single factor in the bulk cancer cell population. In 2 to 3 weeks, it turns these cells back into these cells, okay, which are highly tumorigenic in castrated conditions. And so how does it do it? We recently found, surprisingly, that we initially thought that just like the OSKM, you know, the Shinya Yamanaka factors, perhaps it has to reactivate the endogenous nano, go up to 4KO4, this kind of thing, the pluripotent nano. To our biggest surprise, the CHIP-seq analysis shows, in somatic cancer cells, the single muscle transcription factor can do that by doing a different way, and that is to engage, dynamically repress, and also engage the lineage-specific transcription factor. In this case, hilariously, so I'm not going to go into detail, it's just probably largely in cell discovery. If you guys have been interested, the concept here is that the bulk cancer cells can be reprogrammed to become stem-like cancer cells by multiple ways. Genetic mutation, such as RB1P10 and/or PBD3, that's the paper that you have to read, because the underlying concept in that science paper is precisely the genetic mutation induced the plasticity in cancer cells, reprogramming good cancer cells into very bad cancer cells. Okay? So, and then you can also do epigenetic, and in this case, for example, this nano obviously goes through kind of transcriptional, post-transcriptional, you know, epigenetic mechanism, because there's no genetic mutation right here. And you can also reprogram plasma cancer cells to become cancer stem-like cells by chronic treatment. And we have the evidence to show that, we already published that the enzalutamide can reprogram about 10% of AR-positive plasma cancer cells into AR-negative stem-like cancer cells. So, is that my last slide? Well, okay, I think this is my last slide. So, basically, the lab, I think this is going to the future. Okay, I can tell you that. Basically, we have in the long-treated human plasma tumors, the majority of tumor cells are phenotypically differentiated, expressing high levels of androgen receptor and PSA. And the two molecular properties make this population of cells ultra-sensitive clinically. And because they represent the bulk of the tumor, right? 80 to 90% or even more. They are very sensitive to anti-androgens. They are highly proliferative. They are therefore sensitive to docetaxel. Therefore, in the clinic, when you treat the patient tumors with radiation, with docetaxel, with androgen receptor, you are accomplishing exactly the same goal. You are debulking tumor cells by wiping out the same population of cells. Therefore, all these three modalities, their clinical benefit is almost the same, 2 to 3 months, 3 to 4 months, because you're targeting the same population. But this population of the cells, many of which have hardcore stem cell activity, they oftentimes are AR negative low, they are dormant, therefore they are not sensitive to anti-androgen therapy, and they are not sensitive to chemotherapy drugs. So our goal here is that we want to identify specific therapeutics for this population of cells, and then use it in combination with the current standard of care therapy. Together, it can potentially delay or even prevent the recurrence and the metastasis. So on that, we have a clinical trial derived from our lab research about to happen right here in Boston. So by doing the CRPC xenograft model, we identify a critical drive in this population that is critical for this cancer stem cell survival, and importantly, it's critical for the evolution of an androgen-sensitive tumor to castration-resistant tumor. So now, we are very optimistic in a few months we're going to start accrue patients. Okay, so with that, any quick questions?
I just have a question. With topical castration, when it becomes castrate-resistant or whatnot, are you taking out a section of the prostate, or
when the patients undergo, so most of the lethal 7 pay tumors will have the whole, that's why it's called a radical prostatectomy. That means the whole organ will come out. About 20 to 25% patients with their organs out in about 12 months or so will experience the rise in PSA. So you can imagine that at the time of diagnosis, their PSA can be as high as 1,000, can be as low as 20 nanograms per ml, but much higher than the normal. What is the normal? Undetectable, or less than 0.4 nanograms per ml. That's the clinical index, okay? When it goes above 1 nanogram, you know, the medical oncology will have a follow-up, but the moment you take out their prostate, oftentimes their PSA will go down to a zero. But then about 20-25% patients will, in about 1 year or so, on average, will see this rising serum PSA. So that's the time when medical oncology will start castrating the patient. Okay, John, let's put you on Lupron. So that's the first line castration, which takes out all the testicular androgen. And then after about 15 months, 13 months, you know, the drops of PSA will come again. So then, okay, now it's time for us to put you on enzalutamide under ribavirin. And then with shorter and shorter interval, PSA will keep bonding. Not only that, most of the custom patients, recurrent tumors patients, will have metastasis. So now you do a bone scan, metastasis is everywhere. So they give chemotherapy and eventually patients die. Any other questions? Okay.
Okay, so with that very nice introduction into the cell biology of prostate cancer, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the work that we're doing in my lab looking at the epigenetics in prostate cancer, DNA methylation in prostate cancer. And an overarching theme to the work that we do in my lab, aside from the specific details of the information I'm going to tell you, I'm more interested in conveying the concepts behind all this to you. And the overarching theme is that epigenetic regulation allows the genome to become responsive to the environment. Epigenetics sets the tone for a transcriptional response to signals. So you can have the same signal hitting two different cells, and you can have different outputs in response to that signal. And epigenetics, the difference between those two cells, is one of the factors that contributes to that different output, that different response. And so epigenetic derangement or epigenetic dysregulation in cancer cells provides an exceptional route for cancer cell evolution as cancer progresses to advanced phenotypes. So, for example, in response to castration, cells that survive and manage to continue to grow have to adapt. One of the ways that they can adapt is by altering the epigenetics. Genetic changes don't have the same type of plasticity because once you make a genetic deletion, for example, you're not going to recreate that gene. Epigenetically, though, if turning off a gene in one scenario is advantageous, that gene could come back on if it's advantageous to do so in a different scenario. So you have this concept of plasticity with epigenetics that you don't have with genetics. And so environmental stresses can drive evolution in cancer through the malignant progression. And so I'm just going to give you some examples that have been studied. So we've studied the impaired mitochondrial function in cancer. So nearly all cancer cell types have impaired mitochondrial function. This causes a lot of stresses to the cell. And we've detected DNA methylation changes that are associated with loss of mitochondrial DNA content. So that's one example of stress. Inflammation. So one example is breast cancer, pregnancy-associated breast cancer. So during the after pregnancy, there's a wave of involution of the ducts for producing milk, and this is associated with a high degree of inflammation. And that inflammation can cause damage. And one of those types of damages is epigenetics. And so there's for the pregnancy-associated breast cancer risk, there's an epigenetic contribution to that. So that's something that we're studying with another colleague. Hormone signaling is another epigenetic or environmental stress that we were just talking about. So there are dynamic changes in DNA methylation related to normal androgen signaling, and these processes can become distorted in prostate cancer. Also, if you have a sudden loss of androgen signaling from castration, for example, we found that there are C5G island methylation that occurs during the progression to castration recurrence. So I'm going to talk in more detail about these two points. Another major research effort in my lab that I'm not going to talk about today are micronutrients. For example, folate metabolism. How does folate metabolism contribute to prostate cancer, and how does that contribute to the epigenetic regulation of prostate cancer? So there's a lot of therapeutic potential in that field that we're exploring a lot. So this is more or less introductory stuff that you just heard from Dr. Tang, but I'm going to go over just very briefly. So normally, testosterone gets into the cell. It's converted by 5-alpha reductase into dihydroxytestosterone, which is the more potent ligand for the androgen receptor. It binds the androgen receptor that's being held in the cytoplasm by a heat shock protein. This ligand-bound receptor dimerizes, becomes phosphorylated, and translocates into the nucleus, where it acts as a transcription factor, regulating gene transcription. And it regulates hundreds of genes. And so the ligand-bound androgen receptor regulates hundreds of genes. Some of them become upregulated, some of them become downregulated, and this can be thought of as the ER-responsive transcriptome. Now normally, in the normal prostate, what this does is it directs terminal differentiation of the luminal epithelial cells of the prostate, directs that glandular development, differentiates those cells to the secretory cells, and blocks their proliferation. So if you think about it in that sense, androgen receptor ought to be a tumor suppressor. Because its job is to tell the cells to become this type of cell and stop. And yet what we just heard is that prostate cancer is instead very dependent upon the androgen receptor. When you get into prostate cancer, what you find is the androgen receptor is still there, still getting into the nucleus, it's still binding genes and directing a transcriptome, but it's a slightly different transcriptome. If you look at the genes that are regulated by androgens in normal prostate compared to prostate cancer, there's a lot of overlap, but there's also a lot of differences. So now, you go from driving terminal differentiation and blocking proliferation to the androgen receptor being used to drive, promote growth and survival. And yet again, you get a different transcriptome in androgen deprivation therapy recurrent prostate cancer. And again, you're now promoting growth and survival despite castrate levels of androgens. So the onset of androgen independence, cells find all kinds of ways to get around the fact that you've limited testicular androgens. You saw a different variation of this slide from Dr. Tain. They can amplify the androgen receptor. The androgen receptor can mutate itself so that it becomes promiscuous, to respond to other factors. There's all kinds of ways. The point is the androgen receptor is still interacting with the genome and driving a transcriptome, a response to that interaction. Now, when you look at mutational load, prostate cancer is kind of at the low end of the spectrum in terms of mutational load compared to other disease sites. Here's liver cancer, colorectal cancer, bladder cancer, head and neck cancer, breast cancer. And so you can see here's prostate cancer. The mutational load in exon mutation rates in prostate cancer is relatively low compared to a lot of different cancers. And yet a cell, in order to be a cancer cell, has to have the cancer phenotype. So where does it get it from? I think that this argues that epigenetics plays a large role in shaping the prostate cancer phenotype. Certainly, the genetic mutations also play a very large role. It's an intersection between those two. And so, what do we know about epigenetics in cancer? So, you probably all were in my lecture last semester in this course where I talked about DNA methylation, so some of this is review. But the basic concept is that normally, you have CpG dinucleotides, and when there are a lot of them in a short stretch, the CpG island, when that island is in the promoter region or near the transcriptional start site of a gene, it's typically unmethylated, and that's a transcriptionally permissive state. Other CpG dinucleotides that are more scattered, not in islands, are often methylated, particularly if they're in repetitive elements. And after going through the carcinogenic process, when you look at the DNA methylome, you see that things flip-flop, that unmethylated CpG island can become methylated in some cases, and that can turn that gene off. So you can get silencing of a tumor suppressor gene, for example, by hypermethylation of the CpG island. And some of the areas, the repetitive elements that were highly methylated and normal become hypomethylated in the cancer. And if you look at all kinds of cancer, you can find that this phenomenon of CpG island hypermethylation occurs, depending on the cancer type, rarely or never, all the way up to maybe 10% of the CpG islands. Typically, what you find is 1 to 3% of CpG islands become aberrantly hypermethylated in various types of cancer. And that methylation is often associated with gene silencing when it's in the CpG island. But one question that we don't really know the answer to is, why does this oxygen become hypermethylated, but not another one. Now, selection is probably an obvious answer in some cases. If you silence gene X and gene X is a tumor suppressor, then maybe there's a selective advantage for Cibijon methylation in gene X. Conversely, if you silence gene Y, and gene Y is important for basic core metabolism, it's probably a bad idea to silence that gene. So you can get some selective pressures, positive and negative, that can force the choice of why this gene and not that gene. But the rate at which Cibijon hypermethylation occurs at high frequency, certain genes, can't be explained just by selective pressure. There's got to be other factors that contribute, and that may be locus susceptibility. And by starting to think about these kinds of questions, we can start to think about what's the mechanism behind the aberrant methylation. How does it get there in the first place? What makes one locus susceptible versus another one not susceptible? So we started to ask this question, could epigenetic mechanisms contribute to a different transcriptome being directed by the same nuclear receptor? So going back to this question of the fusion receptor, which is normally going to be driving terminal differentiation and blocking proliferation of normal prosthetic epithelial cells, but in cancer is instead actually driving the cancer. How is that different? The androgen receptor itself is not mutated. So could it be that epigenetic mechanisms are contributing to that different transcriptome? Putting this question another way, could the epigenetic marks reflect that different transcriptome that's being directed by that same nuclear receptor? So to begin to ask this question, a long time ago, we collected some samples from some collaborators here. We had 15 benign prostatic hyperplasia samples, and these kind of approximate normal prostate. This is not a premalignant lesion, it's a hyperplastic lesion. We got 13 androgen-stimulated prostate cancers, which we enriched to greater than 70% carcinoma, which is a technical thing that's actually very important for this kind of analysis. And we got our hands on some very rare tumors, 12 androgen deprivation therapy recurrent tumors. These were not metastases, these were localized recurrences that were collected by transurethral resection during the urinary symptoms during PDT. And we performed something called restriction landmark genomic scanning analysis to measure Cibijon hypermethylation. And the method is an old method that we don't really use anymore, but what we found is of interest. So what we were able to do with this approach was to assess the methylation state of about 1,200 CBG islands using methylation-sensitive restriction enzymes. And what we found is that there's very little CBG island hypermethylation in BPH. So this is the number of methylated CBG islands. Each dot here is a sample. So there's very little CBG island methylation in BPH, which is to be expected because these are non-malignant cells. When we look at the androgen-stimulated prostate cancer, we see an increase in Cibijon methylation, similar to what we see in other types of cancer. This is not unexpected. But when we looked at the recurrent cancers, we saw a huge increase of Cibijon hypermethylation. The number of islands that are hypermethylated in this stage of the disease is much higher. Now, these are not paired, right? So it's not as if these are the same patients as these patients. But it really does show this big increase. And to put that into perspective, over the years, we had looked at about over 200 samples and measured these same 1,200 CPG islands to ask how frequently they get methylated in various types of cancer. And recurrent prostate cancer is at the top of the list, with 7.4% of these CPG islands hypermethylated, compared to the androgen-stimulated prostate cancer, which showed 2.8%. And this is more than double the next highest cancer type, glioblastoma. So there's really a dramatic increase in the amount of Cibijon hypermethylation. So that's using a relatively low resolution, older method. So when these Illumina arrays came out, that can allow us to look at, I believe it's the 450K bead array. This allows us to measure the CPG methylation at 450,000 positions in the genome. And each probe on this array, this is based on bisulfite treatment. So you take DNA, you bisulfite treat it, methylated Cs remain a C, unmethylated Cs become a U, eventually a T. And then you hybridize that to this bead array, this probe. And these probes, for each locus, have two forms, an unmethylated form and a methylated form. You can take the ratio of signal between those two. And so for every CpG position, you get a percent methylation. And so what this is we've compared three androgen-independent tumors, or these ADT-RCAP tumors, to three androgen-dependent tumors. And we're looking at the score for all of the probes, the average score for the three, compared to the average score of the androgen-dependent. And these lines represent a difference of 34%. So everything above this line is a change, a difference that can be considered real. And then the red indicates statistically significant differences. And so what this is showing is that this, it's confirming the RLGS result that I showed before, which is showing this huge increase in methylation in the androgen-independent state. Some loci are more methylated and androgen-dependent, but many more are hypermethylated in the androgen-independent state. And this is one way of doing the analysis. Another way to do the analysis that might be more biologically meaningful is this way. So here we're just treating each individual probe as an isolated entity. But we know biologically that when a CpG ion is hypermethylated, it's that group of methylation events that's meaningful, because that's what's turning off the gene. Single methylated C within an island is most likely not going to turn off the gene. And so we can do this region-level analysis where CpG probes, probe 2, 3, and 4, are nearby each other, and if they're behaving in the same way, we can give that a single score. So now you see far less dots on this plot, because we've collapsed the data set a bit into regions. But still, again, you see the same thing. Many more hypermethylated regions in the androgen-independent than in the androgen-dependent. So then what we can do is we can say, okay, what genes are associated with these CpGs? What genes are becoming hypermethylated, specifically in the androgen-independent phenotype? And then you can do something called gene set enrichment analysis. Gene set enrichment analysis is where you're basically taking, you're asking the question, I have a list of genes that are some experimental condition. And I want to know, is there a particular thing that's enriched in this list of genes? So here we're taking a list of genes that were hypermethylated specifically in androgen-independent prostate cancer. And when we did gene set enrichment analysis, we saw significant enrichment of genes that some other researcher found is downregulated in metastatic prostate cancer. Well, that makes sense, right? We've got a more advanced stage of disease. We're looking at genes that are hypermethylated specifically in that advanced stage of disease. And we know that hypermethylation in CpG islands should be associated with downregulated genes. So this makes sense. It's kind of a sanity check. When you look at genes that are upregulated in metastatic prostate cancer, you don't see any enrichment. So again, that makes sense. So regions hypermethylated specifically in the androgen-independent form are enriched for genes found to be downregulated in metastatic CAP from patients who failed ADT. We also found that hypermethylation can restrict promoter choice away from differentiation. And we found that when we found estrogen receptor beta binding motifs enriched in our set of genes that are hypermethylated. Okay, so again, to walk you through this, we've got genes hypermethylated specifically in androgen-independent prostate cancer, and we find that they're enriched for being targets of estrogen receptor beta. So all these genes on this side of the line are... So what you're looking at here, each of these lines are one of 196 ER-beta targets. These are hypermethylated in androgen-independent prostate cancer. These are not. Interestingly, estrogen receptor beta, so first of all, estrogen receptor beta is a nuclear receptor, just like androgen receptor is. It works in a similar way. Binds a ligand that gets it into the nucleus. Then it acts as a transcription factor directing a transcriptome. It can also interact with the androgen receptor to change the androgen receptor transcriptome. So estrogen receptor beta itself is methylated and silenced in early stage disease. And when that happens, you just don't have that transcription factor, so you've ablated that transcriptional program. But what researchers have found is that estrogen receptor beta is re-expressed in late-stage disease, therefore re-establishing that downstream estrogen receptor signal. And what we're showing here is that it's not the same signal as it was before, because that signal has been skewed by hypermethylation of these 77 genes out of 196 targets. And so when you ask, okay, well, in what way is the estrogen receptor beta transcriptome being skewed by methylation? What we found is that these ER beta targets that are methylated enrich for genes that are involved in differentiation, cell fate decisions, and gland development. Exactly the kinds of genes you wouldn't want to turn on if you're trying to become an advanced cancer. When we looked at the other genes, the 119 that are not methylated, we didn't see any enrichments for any specific phenotypes. So, this skewed signaling is really kind of a key idea here about how DNA methylation isn't just shutting down a transcriptional output, it's changing the possibility of that output. By having ER-beta present in this advanced phenotype, the cell's gaining the ability to regulate these genes, but not having the ability to regulate these genes because of the aberrant methylation. And we don't know exactly why the cell wants to regulate these genes by ER-beta. We haven't gotten into that yet. But it is encouraging to understand that the cancer does gain an advantage by not regulating these genes, because these genes would be driving differentiation and cell fate decisions. So to summarize this part, CBGN hypermethylation is common in androgen-stimulated prostate cancer. So androgen-stimulated prostate cancer, the rate of methylation that we saw was pretty high compared to others, but it's much higher, dramatically increased, in the recurrent form, more than double than we found in any other cancer type. And this dramatically different CPG-island methylation landscape in the recurrent form suggests that the way in which androgen receptor interacts with the genome may also be dramatically different, leading to a different transcriptional output. So what's the biological significance of these observations? So here what we're looking at is the frequency distribution of methylation events, and I'll walk you through this. So here in green is BPH. So in BPH, we looked at a total of 15 samples. We found a total of 76 CBG islands hypermethylated. Now we're asking, at what frequency were each of those 76 islands methylated? So here, we can see that about 70 of them are methylated in two cases. Right? About 20 of them are methylated in four cases, etc. When you go to the androgen-stimulated prostate cancer, we've more than doubled the number of CBG islands that are methylated, but the frequency distribution is the same. About 70% are methylated in 2 of 13 cases, about 20% are methylated in 4 of 13 cases. Okay, so this frequency distribution is more or less the same between BPH and the androgen-stimulated prostate cancer. But when you look at the androgen-independent form, not only have we more than doubled the amount of CBG islands, the number of different CBG islands that are hypermethylated, we've increased the frequency at which they've become hypermethylated. Because now, you've got something like 15% of 388 are methylated in 6 out of 12. Whereas here, you're looking at less than 5% of the islands methylated in 6 out of 15 or 6 out of 13. Okay, so more locites are methylated, but they're also methylated more frequently. So this suggests then that there's some level of selection of those targets. Because if they weren't being selected, they wouldn't be methylated at a high frequency. So what's the basis of that selection? Is it functional? The methylation of that locus helps in acquisition of the phenotype? That's that selection concept, positive selection I was talking about before. Or is it based on locus susceptibility? So maybe these 15% become highly susceptible to become targets of the broken methylation machinery. So here's what I showed you before. This is the dogma. This is the paradigm. You go from an unmethylated island to a hypermethylated island. The reality is more of this. Okay, the reality is that you don't have a completely unmethylated CPG island. Right? You got this one's got 10%, this one's got 20% methylation. So this difference between the paradigm and the reality, is it a meaningful difference or is it just nitpicking? Well, in terms of the gene being on or off, it's nitpicking. All right? This gene's going to be on. Even with that low level of methylation, it's going to be on. And this gene's going to be off. But it might be meaningful in terms of understanding the process. How do you get from an unmethylated island to a methylated island? Because think about what this means, right? If you've got 10% methylation at that CpG position, what does that mean? Well, in any one cell, there's two alleles. So you can have three outcomes. You can be 0% methylated, you can be 50% methylated, or you can be 100% methylated. But you've got a population of cells. So every one of those cells has one of those three outcomes. And you add that all together, then you get your 10% methylation. So, okay, well, how about this cell here, this CpG that's 20%? The cells that have methylation, the 10% of the population of cells that have methylation here, are those the same population of cells that have methylation here? So that in those cells, you've got 100% methylation at those two positions? Or is it more complicated than that? And what's the basis of all that? So if we can begin to understand how this is regulated in the normal scenario, we might shed some light how we get from a normal state to this cancer state. And so all of this comes down to understanding the complexity of chromatin dynamics in response to transcription. Okay, so here's an example of a different nuclear receptor, RAR, RXR. So you can think of this as just a replacement for androgen receptor. They work in similar methods. And you also have to understand that any locus is in some sort of dynamic equilibrium in terms of histone modifications that are either in a primed for transcription state or transcriptionally silent state. It can be activated to have strong level of transcription, or it can be permanently silenced, that's stable silencing. And what determines that are the transcription factors that bind at that locus. And when those transcription factors bind at that locus, they change the relative ratios of, just to keep it simple, histone acetylases and histone deacetylases. Okay, so here we have RAR retinoic acid receptor alpha binding its recognition site, but there's no ligand here. And so in this scenario, it binds to co-repressors, SMART and COR, which recruit histone deacetyltransferases, which shifts this dynamic equilibrium towards silencing because you're deacetylating those histones. If you remember from my lecture last semester, transcriptional activation is associated with acetylated histones, whereas transcriptional silencing is associated with deacetylated histones. So here, basically by this transcription factor coming in and binding and recruiting this complex, it shifts whatever that balance was locally between HATs and HDACs. This is acetyltransferases and this is deacetylases towards silencing. Now, a signal comes in. In this case, the signal is retinoic acid. Retinoic acid binds the receptor. That changes the conformation. Now, instead of interacting with a co-repressor, it interacts with a coactivator. And that coactivator brings with it histone acetyltransferase activity. So now, again, you've shifted the balance towards acetylation or towards activation. All of this is happening in real time, dynamically. None of these states are static. So these things are binding and falling off constantly. By adding the ligand, you're just shifting that balance. This then allows for a more open chromatin structure and allows for the formation of a transcriptional initiation complex, which is more stable, and now fires and turns on the gene. Now, we know, so that's normal regulation. Now, we know that there's abnormal regulation in these types of scenarios that can occur. And in this case, it's been studied for the retinoic acid receptor, that if retinoic acid receptor is altered, if it's absent, or if it's bound up with an antagonist, it shifts things towards repression. You allow acquisition of H3K9 methylation, and these details don't matter so much. But the point is that you get negative chromatin marks signaling for DNA methylation changes. It kind of cements that inactive state. So aberrant function of this transcription factor, of this nuclear receptor, pushes the equilibrium towards stable silencing with histone methylation and DNA methylation. So you have this dynamic situation where when you add ligand, you get rapid dynamic changes. And if you measure transcription rates over time, the transcription rate will be dynamic. And this is measured over the order of minutes to hours. So a signal comes in to turn a gene on. That promoter doesn't just continuously fire. It goes through bursts where it fires at a high rate, and then it's off for a short time. Then it comes back on, it's firing at a high rate if the signal is still there. So that's what this is representing. So on the y-axis we have x-axis we have time, on the y-axis we have quantity. Right, so transcription rate is high and then it's low, etc. It oscillates. This is normal function. And so you get this dynamic of high acetylation, low acetylation. And that's here we're looking at actually methylation of, let's see. So this is nuclear receptor binding. So think of AR or RAR, retinoic acid receptor, we were just talking about. That oscillates. It oscillates in sync with histone modifications, so acetylation, like I showed in the previous, also changes in H3K9 and H3K4 methylation, but in opposition. Right? Activation is associated with loss of methylation of K9, but gain of methylation of K4, so that's what we're looking at here. So we've got a peak of transcription at this time point, we've got a peak of K4 methylation, and a valley of K9 methylation. So all of this is changing rapidly. If you have absence of ligand or some other disruption of this process, you can push things to one extreme where things can become more permanent. The difference here is that here you've got transient silencing, which is regulated silencing, but if you go to the extreme, you no longer have a regulatable locus. You can no longer respond to the positive signal. So the fundamental difference in how you push things over the edge is an intense area of research. So all of that I just told you has been known for probably 10 years. Much more recently was the recognition that DNA methylation also shows these dynamics. For the longest time, we didn't know that DNA methylation was dynamic at all. But recently, there have been some studies for, again, nuclear receptors, estrogen receptor, vitamin D receptor, PPAR gamma. Some specific genes have been shown that showed that in opposition to the expression changes, you have changes in DNA methylation that oscillate. And so we came up with this hypothesis that dynamic cyclical changes in DNA methylation might occur broadly, of course, across the genome in response to androgen receptor stimulation in non-malignant cells. And if true, such dynamic regions may be susceptible to aberrant DNA methylation and heterochromatization in malignant cells. So the idea is this: if we can understand what's going on in the normal biology of androgen receptor directing changes in DNA methylation in a normal dynamic process, we can then postulate the idea that maybe that dynamic process gets broken, and therefore those regions where this occurs might become hypersusceptible to aberrant methylation cancer. All right? So to get at this, we use this cell line, HPR1AR. The problem with non-malignant prostate cell lines is that they don't express androgen receptor, because if they did express androgen receptor, they would stop growing and they would terminally differentiate. So there's this line, which is immortalized. It doesn't express AR, but we can add exogenous androgen receptor, which when we grow the cells in the absence of androgens, will stay localized in the cytoplasm. So it's not directing the transcription. But then, when we add ligand, we can trigger the release of that into the nucleus, and it will drive a differentiation program, and ultimately lead the cells to stop proliferating. So it's kind of a cell line model of differentiation. And this is going from a more basal epithelial cell-like condition to a more luminal condition. And so this is just to demonstrate that, in fact, the differentiation program works. So this is a set of genes actually identified by Dr. Kang from human luminal epithelial cells. that are highly expressed in luminal epithelial cells. And what we've done is we've taken this HPR1AR cell line that's grown without androgens, and then we add androgens at time zero. And then we looked at time zero. We looked at time 1 hour, 24 hours, and 96 hours after the addition of androgens. And we looked to see how these genes are changing their expression patterns. So time zero, these genes are all off. At 1 hour, you start to see some of them come up. All the reds are genes that are being upregulated. At 24 hours, more of them. At 96 hours, even more of them. So this model system is, you know, it's not normal. They're growing in tissue culture flask, and they've got HPV infection. So they're not normal, but they're approximating that normal process of differentiation response to androgens. So it's a model system that we can use. And we can ask, is there a relationship between genes normally regulated by AR and aberrant methylation in cat prostate cancer? So here are the 10 genes most highly upregulated by androgens in these cells. And here is the data that we had from androgen-stimulated prostate cancer or androgen-independent prostate cancer, showing the percent methylation at these genes. And you can see that nearly all of these genes are highly methylated, especially in androgen-independent prostate cancer. So again, the 10 most responsive genes in this cell line model, when we add androgens, are highly methylated in prostate cancer, lending support to this concept. And here, this is the genes that are downregulated in multiple publicly available gene expression studies looking at prostate cancer. So this kind of validates the basis behind the idea, the hypothesis. So now we're going to treat cells with androgens, DHT, and we're going to collect nascent RNA, so that's newly transcribed RNA coming off of a promoter, every 15 minutes. And we're going to use that to measure the transcription rate, and we're going to measure the DNA methylation at each time point and ask if methylation changes are occurring in relation to transcription changes. So we looked at one gene, SGK1. And here what you're looking at is the transcription rate. So at time zero, there's very little transcription. At time 45 minutes, we start to see an increase. By an hour and 15, we get a peak in transcription rate, which then drops again and then stabilizes. So this is all biological triplicates with no artificial synchronization. And then we took those exact same cells, and we did bisulfite sequencing to look at the methylation level at all of these CpGs. So here's CpG number one, basically nothing going on, essentially no changes. Same for CpG number two, a little bit at 3-4, but then the CpG number five is really interesting because it's showing a peak during the period where it's silent, and then when transcription rate goes high, the methylation level goes down. And this is highly reproducible. So again, these error bars represent biological triplicates. So what this tells us then is that some CpGs do show dynamics in methylation level that are in relation to the transcription rate. And more importantly, this was strand-specific and ligand-specific. So when you do bisulfite sequencing, you're only sequencing one strand, because by converting C's to T's, you've changed, the strands are no longer complementary to each other. So when you design primers, you're designing it from one strand. So you can design primers to the other strand as well, and you can then get the methylation information on both strands independently. So that's what we've done here. So here's the one that I showed you. Here's the reverse strand, no dynamics going on. And here is this same strand in the condition where we didn't add DHT, but went across the same timeline. So it's strand-specific and it was ligand-specific. So then we ask, can we apply this concept genome-wide? This is just one gene. I had a PhD student do all this work. It was a real pain in the butt. He's collecting every 15 minutes. Nascent RNA, DNA, bisulfite converting it, doing it in biological triplicates. It's like ridiculous. We actually did a 4-hour window. I'm only showing you the first 2 hours. So that was a lot of work. It was also really expensive. But now we want to ask, can we do this in a whole genome bisulfite sequencing based approach? But we can't do all these time points because it's prohibitively expensive. So we did 1 hour, 24 hours, and 96 hours. We wanted to ask, do we see global variation in methylation over time? It's all well and good to find this one CpG in this one locus that's showing it, but how broad is this? I'm not going to show you the data, but even though this is just this one CBG that's showing these dynamics, it's actually meaningful because when we clone that region in front of a reporter system, that region made the reporter energy dependent, and it did not drive transcription if we artificially methylated it. So this methylation event is controlling transcription. Another question we can ask is, do these sites correlate with differential gene expression? So we find global methylation, we know that gene expression changes, is there a relationship between those two things? And then we can finally ask the question we really want to get to, are these sites susceptible to aberrant methylation in cancer? So I'm just going to take you through this data quickly to see what we found. So first of all, this is the results of the whole genome bisulfite sequencing, where you're doing it, we're looking at a clustering dendrogram, which is basically showing how related these samples are to each other. We've got about 11 million CPG data points per time point. So it's a lot of data that we're comparing to each other. And basically what this is telling you is that time zero looks almost exactly like hour one. So 1 hour post-androgens, there's not a lot of difference between in the methylation. Then there's more difference once we go to 24 hours, and more difference again once we get to 96 hours. So this makes sense, right? If our idea is right, that there are dynamic changes in DNA methylation in response to the addition of ligand, this is what we would have predicted to see. So that's encouraging. And then you can start to ask questions like, okay, how many sites are showing differences in methylation? Then you have to ask, well, how do you define a difference in methylation? So one way to define it is just simply 10% compared to time zero. So at hour one, there's a million CPGs that differ between time zero and 1 hour, etc. So there's lots, there's millions of changes. If you shift that criteria to 30%, you get into more manageable numbers that are a little easier to understand and maybe more biologically relevant. So again, there's lots of changes. You're still looking at 50,000, 40,000, 70,000 changes. But all this is kind of a superficial analysis. It's hard to really take any meaning out of this. It says that these things are happening, but you're not getting a sense of what's the functional meaning of this. So this gobbledygook slide probably doesn't clarify anything for you, but give me a minute and I think it will. So one of the problems with this data is that it's very expensive to generate. So to do the whole genome bisulfite sequencing on those four time points costs about $25,000, which means we didn't do it in biological triplicates. We just did it once. But if you're doing that, and you're looking at relatively small changes in CPG islands from time to time to time, how do you have any confidence that it's a real change and not just noise in the system? Because you don't have replicates. If you have replicates, that's easy, right? You use statistics. But we don't have that. So what we decided to do is to think of our time series as, in a sense, replicates. So what we could do is we could look for where there are progressive changes. Could we find changes from time 0 to 1, and that same locus showed a change in the same direction from 1 to 24? And again, that gives us confidence that it's a real change and not just noise. So if we simply set that criteria that there's more methylation in hour 1 and then again more at 24 and more at 26, this is how many CPGs there are. You can look at the inverse of that, loss of methylation. This is how many there are, blah, blah, blah. You could set different types of criteria where the minimum jump has to be 10%. That's what all this nonsense means. Each jump has to be 10%, and that's a pretty restrictive when only 711 CPGs showed a minimum of a 10% increase between each time point. What we decided to focus on was this here, where there was progressive increase or progressive decrease, and the overall decrease was at least 20%, or the overall increase was at least 20%. And that got us into some reasonable numbers that we could start to work with. And we defined these as methylation variable positions, or MVPs. So they're defined as showing progressive change over time and totaling greater than 20% methylation change. So the overall amount of change we get is something that we think is probably biologically meaningful, and we can trust that it's real because it's progressive. So we end up with 128,000, 129,000 MVPs out of a total of 11 million CPGs that we looked at. 26,000 of them are associated with transcriptional start sites, and that's where we're going to focus on initially because that's what where we understand DNA methylation to be playing an important role. And we found that about 6,500 transcriptional start sites have two or more of these methylation variable positions, 5,700 only have one, and then there's 14,000 that have no methylation variable position. And so then we can go from that and start to ask, how does that compare to publicly available data about aberrant methylation in prostate cancer? So first, I'll just give you an example of what these data look like. Each of these dot positions here is a CPG position, in this case for the ACADM gene. And the color indicates the time point that we're looking at. And this is the change in methylation level relative to the previous time point. And so here's a 10 kV window around the transcriptional start site of a gene with no methylation variable positions. So this is what it looks like. There's a little bit of noise through here, but they're not consistent, and it's relatively low levels of change. So here's a gene that has a number of methylation variable positions. All of these right here, and maybe this over here, and over here. So here's a good example, this cluster right here. As we go through time, there's more. This is the latest time point, 96 hours. You can see there's more of a change in methylation. And so then here's the real finding. If we limit ourselves to the 6,500 genes that had two or more methylation variable positions, and we compared it to the TCGA prostate cancer data set to ask what genes does TCGA say are hypermethylated in prostate cancer in at least two studies, that number is 467. So we know from hundreds of prostate cancer cases that there's 467 genes showing aberrant methylation. And we can ask, what's the overlap between those two? And then we can use statistics to see if that's significant. And we get an overlap of 274. So more than half of what is methylated in prostate cancer in our non-malignant system, just responding to androgens that have two or more of these methylation variable positions, show overlap. So that is a very significant p-value. Right? So genes containing greater than two MVPs are highly enriched as targets of aberrant methylation in prostate cancer. So that's encouraging. Even more encouraging is this. If we look at the ones that have one methylation variable position, that goes away. You get a very small overlap. So it's not significant. And if we look at the ones that have zero MVPs, again, a small amount of overlap. Consider you're comparing almost 14,000 genes. The chances of getting this small of an overlap are actually remotely tiny. So in fact, non-MVP-containing genes are de-enriched as targets of methylation in cancer. So the questions that we were asking at the beginning of this, do we see global variation in methylation over time? Definitely, yes, we do. Do these sites correlate with differential gene expression? We don't know the answer to that yet. We're working on that. It's a complicated analysis. Seems like it should be simple, but it's not so simple. Are these sites susceptible to aberrant methylation in prostate cancer? It seems that the answer to that is yes. There's strong evidence that CPG regions that demonstrate dynamics in methylation levels during this quasi-normal androgen-driven basal to luminal epithelial cell differentiation are hypersusceptible to aberrant methylation in prostate cancer. So, to me, this emphasizes the critical need for understanding normal epigenetic regulation in order to gain insights into cancer-specific epigenetic dysregulation. I think that's all I have. Any questions? Yeah?
It seems like using methylation instead of genetic changes would protect tumors against the immune system, for example. Because you're reducing the number of targets. Why is not every other cancer like following this strategy of having very little mutation and more methylation?
So I wouldn't I wouldn't agree with your initial premise that there's less immune targets after epigenetic changes. In fact, one strategy to increase immunogenicity is to inhibit DNA methylation patterns so that genes that shouldn't be expressed become expressed and can become neoantigens. I take your point, though, that a lot of neoantigens come from mutations, right? So because the cell's never seen this before, or the body's never seen this before. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. I will say that nearly all tumor types, there's only one that I can think of that doesn't, nearly all tumor types have a lot of DNA methylation, aberrant DNA methylation. So epigenetics contributes to all cancer types. It's just to different degrees. Same as genetic mutation contributes to all cancer types, including prostate. But again, it's just to different degrees. Why is that? I don't know. It probably has a lot to do with the cell of origin. Environmental exposure. Environmental exposure is actually a big factor. The cancer types that have the highest rates of mutations are like colon, lung, bladder. They get a lot of carcinogen exposure compared to prostate. So that's part of it. Yes? I don't know. I actually don't know if I'm going to have any questions. Maybe I'll come up with something that's more general. So I guess the take-home message to that is that I'm not going to be asking any specific detail out of these slides. As I said at the beginning, it's more about the concepts. All right. Thank you.